to the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. Today is Monday, April 4th, 2022. I'm Senator Costello. I'd like to welcome Senate President Senator Michicki. Welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chairman.
And we have Senator Gray Jackson. Welcome.
Welcome. Thank you, Madam Chair.
And Senator Stevens will be arriving after his other commitment that he has, and Senator Rivak is excused for today. I'd also like to take a moment and thank our recording secretary, Carrie, thank you, and Doug, the LIO operator, for making the meeting possible this afternoon. Today we have two items on the agenda. We have consideration of governor's appointees, and also we have House Bill 55, Peace Officer, Firefighter, Retire Benefits. This is the second hearing for that bill, and we will have invited testimony on House Bill 55. First, I would like to welcome Christopher Dean, who is an appointee to the Alaska Workers' Compensation Board. And Chris, if you could introduce yourself to the committee and share with the committee why you're interested in serving on the Workers' Compensation Board, and share any challenges that you see that the board might be facing and any other issues that you would like the committee to know.
Thank you. Really, Chair, and for the record, my name is Christopher Dean. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of Senate Labor and Commerce. Thank you for the opportunity to introduce myself and answer any questions you may have in support of my appointment to the Alaska Workers' Compensation Board. To briefly introduce myself, I moved to Alaska in 1987 as a freshman in high school, continued my education at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, graduating in 1996, and ultimately establishing my professional career in Fairbanks. My background is predominantly healthcare related, both in care delivery and administration, and I currently serve in a multitude of roles for Foundation Health Partners. Additionally, as a licensed athletic trainer, I serve the community of Fairbanks, providing direct healthcare, safety advocacy, and education to athletes of all competition levels throughout our community, and oversee a robust sports medicine outreach program on behalf of our organization. I have a long history of professional and civic service and enjoy the opportunities to serve my profession and my community. I have served on boards and committees at the local, state, and national levels, fully understanding and respecting the responsibility that this appointment represents. I look forward to the opportunity to serve the state of Alaska and its workforce if my appointment is confirmed. If there are any questions for me, I'd be happy to answer at this time.
Thank you very much, Chris. My only question is, have you served this board in the past, or are you going to be a new appointee?
Thank you for the question, Madam Chair. I was appointed last year to this board in the labor seat and was ultimately had my appointment rescinded. I'm waiting for a industry seat to open. I think I said that correctly.
Thank you very much.
So this will be, I will be a new member at this point. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions that committee members have? Okay, seeing none. Christopher, thank you very much for making yourself available to the committee today and also for your willingness to serve on this very important board. And I just wanted to let all of the appointees know that we will be forwarding all of the names at once so that they will all be read across on the floor together. But all the names will be going forward for a full vote by a joint House and Senate meeting, which is scheduled for later in the month. So thank you, Chris.
Thank you.
Next, I would like to invite Clay Besnick, who's an appointee to the Fisherman's Fund Advisory and Appeals Council. Clay, if you could introduce yourself to the committee and let us know if this is a new appointment and or if it's a reappointment and why you were interested in serving on this important council.
Hello, everybody, Senator Costello and all the members of the committee. I've been on the board since Governor Palin appointed me back a couple of years ago, and I'm very honored to be the longest sitting member on the board. It's really a great privilege to be serving on a board that was started in 1951 before statehood, and 100% of the money that's gone through the Fisherman's Fund has come out of fishermen's permit cards and crew licenses, so we've never had to depend or ever will have to depend on the legislature for appropriations. And also, it's a great privileged to know that there were fishermen that actually thought about taking care of their fellow fishermen back that long ago. I'm sorry, I have a deer in my back in my backyard here. My dog. I'm sorry, I'm going crazy, sir. I don't know if you can see it. No, you can't see the deer. Welcome to the world.
We've never had a deer attend the Labor and Commerce Committee.
Well, it's the first time for everything, right?
Just don't shoot it while we're here.
It's time to have babies, not to harvest them. So
I know.
But yeah, I actually serve on the Pacific Salmon Commission also, and for the state of Alaska as a fisherman representative. And I've been fishing since 1983 all over the state. And now I've just kind of stuck around Ketchikan the last years here as I'm getting a little bit older. And I appreciate everybody serving in the legislature equally as much.
Thank you very much, Clay. Do committee members have any questions for Clay, who's an appointee to the Fisherman's Fund Advisory and Appeals Council? Okay, seeing none. Well, thank you very much for making yourself available today to the committee and for providing that interesting moment with the deer in your backyard.
Life's never dull. Thanks a lot.
Next, I'd like to invite Devin Thomas, who is an appointee to the Real Estate Commission. Devin, welcome to the committee, and thank you for making yourself available to us to introduce yourself and share why you're interested in serving on this board.
Well, thank you for having me. My name is actually Devin Duran now, so I got married. So my name is no longer Devin Thomas, and I think that reflects that on the commission website. But currently, I am the broker owner of Signature Real Estate Alaska, located in the Matsu Valley. I'm a lifelong resident of Wasilla. I was born and raised here and have been a realtor pretty much my entire adult life. I was a graduate of Pawnee High School and then just left for a short time to go obtain my bachelor's degree at Chaminade University in Honolulu, then came back to Alaska, where I've been selling real estate pretty much ever since. I was mentored into the business by a gentleman by the name of Kaibi Lucas. He was currently serving as a local president when I started working with him, and he was serving as the local president for our local board of realtors. He pretty much told me on my first day to pick a committee and serve on it. And so from that day forward, I realized how important it was to give back to our industry and to stay involved with our industry, and that it was just more than a transacting business. I've served in lots of leadership roles as my time as a realtor. I've actually been to the Hill Visits in Juneau and in Washington, D.C., where I've served both as a local, state, and national director for our local board of realtors. In 2017, I served as the president of the Alaska Association of Realtors, and that was, if you were in the legislature at the time, that was definitely a trying year for us with a lot of issues that have been going on for a long time that I was able to navigate through. I've been interested in serving on the Real Estate Commission for a long time. I've attended their meetings regularly, and what I think I can bring to the Real Estate Commission is a representation of both the Matsu Valley and Anchorage, which our office currently serves, and that's where a majority of the licensees in the state of Alaska live. Also, I am a licensed trainer, educator, and mediator, which is something that is a little bit unique to some of what's currently serving on the Real Estate Commission. I've actually already had the opportunity to give back since my appointment and help with the guidelines for the continuing education of the real estate and of the next renewal cycle for real estate licensees. And I'm just really excited about serving in this capacity. I am probably a weird sort of realtor that actually enjoys reading the statutes and regulations. As a broker, that's been really important to me, and I'm just looking forward to giving back.
Well, thank you very much, Devin. And I have to say, I've had two constituents email me in support of your appointment to this board, and they actually are your competitors. And so I can't think of a more stellar recommendation than to have folks who, you know, are out there in the private sector competing, but who just really look up to you and think that this appointment is really going to be good for the commission. They've said you're a really hard worker and you're going to be a real asset. So that's all I have to pass on to you. Do any of the members have questions for Devin? Senator Michicki?
Well, that's one way to take it. The other way is she's beating them, that they, I think they want to keep her tied up doing something else for a little while. No, I read both of those, and that is really good to see and really unique from a competitor. So that does speak volumes.
That's really nice to hear. I do my best to, real estate's an interesting business in that we're one of the only sales businesses I know that it requires the cooperation of our competitors to be successful. And I think that's a neat part about it. So our industry relationships are actually really, really important to our success.
Okay, thank you. And Senator Gray Jackson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so here's another feel-good comment. With the truth, I received an email from a friend of mine highly recommending you, and I just wanted to also share that. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for sharing that.
Devin, thank you for making yourself available to the committee today, and I appreciate your willingness to serve on an important board such as the Real Estate Commission.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity.
And we'll take a brief at ease. Welcome back to the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee, and thank you for your patience. We had had to just shore up the folks who are calling on the telephone. And next, I'd like to invite Gabrielle King, who's an appointee to the Social Work Examiners Board. Gabrielle, if you could introduce yourself to the committee and explain your interest in serving on this board, and also if you're a reappointment or a first-time appointee to the board. Okay, we'll take a brief at ease. We are here going over some governor's appointees, and the next appointee is Gabrielle King to the Board of Social Work Examiners. Gabrielle, I think we can hear you now, so if you want to introduce yourself to the committee and explain your interest in serving on the board.
Hi, can you hear me now?
Yes, we can hear you.
Great. So for the record, good afternoon. My name is Gabrielle King, and I currently reside in North Pole. I am interested in serving on the Board of Social Work Examiners as a public member. I came to Alaska in 2016 as an infantryman stationed on Fort Wainwright. Honorably discharged in early 2018, I now operate my photography business full-time, traveling to all corners of the state. I am also currently pursuing a bachelor's degree in political science at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. I am interested in serving on the Board of Social Work Examiners, as I believe it is a way to give back to my community. Mental health and social services are an integral component for all of us, especially in Alaska. It is imperative that everyone has safe and efficacious access to quality providers in their respective programs. In serving with the board, I believe I can bring fresh perspective to any matters to which the board faces. I'm happy to answer any questions and will return to any that I'm unsure of at a later time. Thank you for the opportunity to introduce myself this afternoon, and this is my first consideration for this board. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Gabrielle. Do any committee members have any questions for Gabrielle? Senator Gray Jackson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Gabrielle, for your willingness to serve. But I'm looking at your resume. Are you still a firefighter?
Thank you for your question. I left the fire service in May of last year to pursue running my business full time, so I am currently not a volunteer or a firefighter.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. No questions. Okay. Gabrielle, thank you very much for your willingness to serve on this board. I guess my only question is, do you have any financial interest in the social work career field? I'm assuming not because you're the public member, but I just wanted to ask.
Thank you. That is correct. I do not have any financial interests or any conflict of interest at this time.
Okay. Well, good luck with your business, and I hope you make it through the appointment process. As I mentioned earlier, we will be forwarding all the names in one batch, and so we won't be doing that this afternoon, but we look forward to hearing more from all of the appointees this afternoon.
Thank you for your time to the committee as well as Madam Chair. I appreciate it.
Next, if Janice Hill could introduce herself for the committee. She's the appointee to the Alcohol Beverage Control Board. So, Janice, we're unable to hear you. Are you calling in? Okay, I think I'm going to move on to Lena Lafferty, who's the governor's appointee to the Board of Nursing. Lena, if you could introduce yourself to the committee and share why you're interested in serving on this board and what seat you're filling and if it's a reappointment or a first-time appointment.
Good afternoon. Yes, my name is Lena M. Lafferty, and this is for a reappointment. I was allowed to I think less than a year ago, and then now I've been hopefully going to get reappointed. So I have been in Alaska for almost 16 years. I came up here with my husband, who was an active duty Marine, and we got stationed up here, and then we stayed. I was in the Navy for 10 years as a hospital corpsman, and I was lucky enough to become a registered nurse almost 8 years ago, so I'm in the position for the RN. I work in the OR over at Providence, Alaskan, at the Providence Hospital. And the reason why I'm hoping to get reappointed is because we're doing so much with what the board's doing. I was lucky enough to chair a committee, and we are getting two sections of the military, the Army LPN, and then the Air Force, who have a certain MOS. We are hopefully very close to allowing them to challenge the LPN board here in Alaska. So that's a great feat that myself and my committee members were able to do. We're waiting for public comment, and then hopefully, if everything goes well, this is something that I spoke to before last year that we were in the middle of doing, so we're that much closer to getting it done. And then hopefully I will be able to get the hospital corpsman, because being that I was in the Navy, I have a, you know, partisan for that, and I would like to get them to have the ability to be able to challenge the LPN board hopefully sometime within my 2 years that I'll be able to get it done, hopefully. And just working with the other members, getting our stuff done during the pandemic, seeing how hard it was, because like I said, working in the hospital, I saw firsthand, not as much as those ICU nurses, not as much. I saw a taste of it, and just trying to make their life easier. Trying to, if they needed something, if we needed to pass emergency licenses, we got it done. You know, seeing that, hey, we're about to have to re-register, but they wanted to put the licensing fee was going to be raised, but we were like, no, you know, they have enough things on their plate. That's something that we don't need to do. We'll do it at another time. The CEUs, we chopped that in half, so less work for them to do so that the nurses could work with the patients and then have some time to lax down and, you know, remind themselves this is the reason why I became a nurse. And, you know, there's always that fine line with working and then being a human also and trying to make it easier for them. And I think with the work that we're doing, and with the other committee, with the other board members, we can just make it better for nurses as a whole. And I'm very grateful, and thank you for the consideration, for listening to me, and if you have any questions, I will hopefully be able to answer them.
Well, Lena, your experience and background certainly seem you know, well suited to the board, and I hope your appointment process goes well. Do committee members have any questions for her? Okay, seeing none, thank you again for making yourself available, both for the committee meeting today and also for your service on the board. I really appreciate that.
Thank you.
Next, Janice Hill again. Janice is an appointee to the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board. Janice, if you could introduce yourself to the committee, and if for some reason the audio doesn't work, we can reschedule your hearing.
Thank you very much. My name is Janice Hill, and I'm a lifelong resident of Haines, and I'm very happy for that. And I have applied to serve on the Alcohol Beverage Control Board, and I have a lot of years of experience serving my community and serving actually the region and in some state committees also. I have recently retired from being the mayor of Haines. I served on the Haines Borough Assembly and also served as the mayor four terms. My first term was actually when we were still a third-class borough, so that broadened my horizons as far as different kinds of borough governments. And throughout my adult life, I've served just in numerous areas, tribal, municipal, local committees, Girl Scouts, just anywhere that I could be of service. I am currently, and what I discovered was very quickly when I retired from being mayor, I am not very good at retirement. So I started looking around to see where I could find some meaningful boards or committees to serve on. I'm still serving on the Southeast Conference Board of Directors. I am currently a member of the Chilkoot Indian Association Tribal Council. I serve on the Search Board of Directors. I am on the Alaska Miners Association Board of Directors. I continue to serve on the Lynn Canal Icy Strait Resource Advisory Committee and a variety of other local committees in Haines. And when I was looking for other things to serve on, I found there was a vacancy on the Alcohol Beverage Control Board. And my interest was spiked because when I was serving on the Alaska Native Health Board, I actually represented tribal health on the Title IV rewrite steering committee. And so I am familiar with the statutes of that the Alcohol Beverage Control Board deals with. And I feel like I could bring a small town perspective to this board. And as you're probably aware, I've already been to three meetings as we're waiting for our confirmation process. But I have already enjoyed my service on this board, and I would appreciate your consideration in confirming my appointment. And if you have any questions, I would be happy to answer them. Thank you.
Thank you, Janice, and you seem really well qualified to continue serving on the board. Senator Michicki has a question for you.
Yeah, Janice, thanks for serving on the Title IV group, and I think you heard a lot of the struggles that the board is going through and will be going through in the future as well. I agree that you're very well qualified and have a not only public health perspective, but a smaller community perspective that I think will be helpful. So thanks for putting your name in the hat.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Janice. Next, I'm going to open up the public testimony. I see there's an individual online. However, that nominee we have not heard from today. So since we have not heard from the Board of Chiropractic Examiners nominee, we will not be taking public testimony on that particular board. We will take any public testimony on Christopher Dean, Lena Lafferty, Clay Besnick, Gabriel King, Devin Duran, and Janice Hill. Is there anyone here in Juneau or online who wishes to provide public testimony on the individuals that I named? Okay, seeing none, public testimony is open and it is now closed. The remainder of the appointees will most likely be on Monday the 11th. So Sherry, if you want to call back to that meeting, we would be happy to take your public testimony then, or you're also free to submit it in writing if you'd like. Okay, now we're going to take a brief at ease before we go into the next portion of the meeting, which is House Bill 55. Committee. Welcome back to this committee. Next on the agenda, we have House Bill 55 related to peace officer and firefighter retirement benefits. And online, we have David Kirshner, who's the principal and consulting actuary for Buck Consulting, along with Scott Young, who's the director of health practice also for Buck Consulting. And their presentation or their analysis of the bill is in the packet. And David and Scott, if you could both introduce yourself to the committee and then provide your testimony, please.
Okay, thank you. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can hear you fine.
Okay, great. Hello, everyone. My name is Dave Kirshner, and I'm the principal and consulting actuary with Buck Global, and I am the lead retirement actuary for on the services that we provide to the Division of Retirement and Benefits for all of the state of Alaska retirement systems. And Scott Young is also on the line. He is the lead health actuary who works with me and others on the work that we do for the DRB. We are here today to discuss the fiscal note cost analysis that we did for the updated or for HB 55. This is our analysis was contained in a letter dated March 4th, 2022. I don't know if the committee members have a copy of that letter in front of them. It would be helpful if they do so I can refer to a couple things in that letter. But let me just first mention, you may have recalled that there was a similar analysis done a year ago for HB 55, and this is an update to that analysis, and there were basically three things that changed in this updated analysis versus the one from last year. The first thing is this updated analysis is based on the recently completed 2021 actuarial evaluations that have been discussed with the Alaska Retirement Management Board. The analysis from last year was based on the 2020 valuation. So there's always changes in participant data from one year to the next that affect the cost analysis. The second difference is the last year's analysis did not reflect SB 55, which went into effect July 1, 2021, and all SB 55 did is it changed the way the state as an employer makes contributions to the PERS trusts versus without SB 55. So you're going to see in this letter, in the updated letter, we have the impact on both the additional state contributions as well as the state as an employer contributions, which, as I said, is due to SB 55 going into effect July 1 of 2021. And then the third update or difference between this letter and last year's is the proposed effective date. It's in this analysis, it's 7/1/22. Last year's analysis, the proposed effective date was 7/1/21. Other than those three differences, our analysis is the same. The provisions of the proposed bill is the same in this letter, cost letter, as well as last year's letter. And so I guess the simplest way to explain why we are projecting increases to the state contributions to the PERS is because we have a shifting of participants from the DCR, the Defined Contribution Retirement Plan, which is referred to as the DCR plan. That's the plan that that is for all post July 1, 2006 hires. In July of 2006, the Defined Benefit Pension Plan for both public employees and teachers were both closed to new entrants and new hires after July 1, 2006 enter the DCR plans currently under HB 55. The current active members in the DCR plan for the peace officers and firefighters will be given a one-time election, whether to stay in the DCR plan or switch over to the defined benefit plan. And then under HB 55, all future hires will enter the defined benefit plan rather than the defined contribution plan. So because of the shifting of the participants between the DCR plan to the DB plan, there is now a shifting of contributions that were currently going into the DCR plan and the DB plan, and now there's a new allocation of those contributions. So if you have a copy of our March 4th, 2022 letter, I would direct you to page 2. And at the top of page 2 is a table that summarizes the increases in the additional state contributions, as well as the state as an employer contributions to PERS for FY23 through FY28. And then in the middle of the page, there are two pie charts. And the pie charts really tell the story. If we look at the pie chart on the left, These are allocations of the employer, the 22% contributions that employers currently make. These are allocations of those 22% contributions to the different trusts. So if you add up all the percentages in both pie charts, they equal 22%. On the left, if we start in the top left, currently PERS employers contribute 5% of employees' pay to their defined contribution accounts. The green is a 3%. That's the amount that currently employers contribute to the participants' health reimbursement accounts, the HRA accounts. The 1.5% in yellow is the portion of the 22% that's currently being contributed to the DCR trust. That's for the occupational death and disability benefits and the retiree health care benefits that the DCR plans currently provide to the members. And then the rest of the orange, the 12.5%, that's the remainder of the 22% that is currently being deposited to the defined benefit trust to help pay down the unfunded liability in that plan. So that's current state. Again, the sum of all those four percentages is 22%. Now we move over to the pie chart on the right, which is an allocation of the same 22% after HB 55. And we'll start in the top left, the green 3%, that is still the employers will continue to contribute 3% of pay to the HRA accounts on behalf of the Peace Fire members who are affected by HB 55. And then in yellow, they're going to be contributing a minimum of 9% there's an HB 55 trust that's proposed to be set up within defined benefit trust, and the contributions, those 9% contributions from the employers will be deposited to that HB 55 trust, and that's to fund the benefits for the Peace Fire members who are affected by HB 55. And so the sum of the yellow 9% and the green 3% is 12%, which leaves 10% in orange to contribute to the defined benefit trust after HB 55. So again, employers are still contributing 22%, but you can see if we focus on the orange portion of the two pie charts, you can see currently about 12.5% of pay is being deposited to the DB trusts for these members, And after HB 55, only 10% will be contributed to the defined benefit trust. That 2.5% shortfall has to be made up by someone, and that's where we get the higher, the increases in the additional state contributions, because the state has to make up that 2.5% shortfall to pay down the unfunded liability that's in the defined benefit plan. And then the increases in the state as an employer contributions, those are due to a couple things. One is when we factor in under SB 55, the state as an employer contributes, instead of contributing just 22%, they contribute the full actuarial contribution rate to both the defined benefit and the defined contribution retirement plan trusts. Because of HB 55, those contribution rates increase slightly, as well as when members are assumed to be participants in the defined benefit plan. Well, let me take a step back. When we do our projections and calculations of future contributions, we have to project which employees are the current group of employees are expected to remain in service and ultimately retire from the state and start receiving a pension benefit from the state, and also healthcare benefits for the participant and their covered spouse and dependent children. So we have to make assumptions about future, what's going to happen to the population, current population. We know not everyone's going to remain employed. We know some people are going to die before retirement, and we know some people are going to become disabled before retirement. So we have a series of assumptions that are made with respect to all of those future events. When members are transferred from the DCR plan into the defined benefit plan, the employee retention is expected to be higher because generally fewer people leave employment when there's a defined benefit, an opportunity to receive a defined benefit pension if they remain in employment. So employee retention is expected to be higher after HB 55 than before HB 55, and as a result, projected payroll is expected to be higher, and because the dollar amounts are just the contribution rate times the projected payroll, that's what leads to the higher state as an employer contributions, as shown in the top half on page 2. There are risk mitigating provisions built into the proposed bill. There are two, essentially. One is that the member contribution rates can be increased by the Alaska Retirement Management Board to up to 12% of pay. There's member contributions are starting at 8% of pay, and they can be increased anywhere between 8 and 12% by action of the board. The board can also reduce the PRPA, which is the post-retirement pension adjustment benefits. The PRPA benefits, these are the benefits that are linked to the CPI, the Consumer Price Index, changes, and depending on the change in the CPI from one year to the next, retired participants and beneficiaries that are receiving pension benefits get like a cost of living increase due to the CPI increases. Under the provisions of the proposed bill, the ARM board can reduce the PRPA benefits for HB 55 members if the funded status of the HB 55 trust falls below 90%. The HB 55 trust is currently about 100% funded with all of the transfers of assets under the proposed bill. And assuming that the assets earn what were expecting it to earn based on the assumptions that the ARM board has adopted, the HB 55 trust is projected to remain well above 90% funded. So we did not reflect in our cost analysis any reduction in those PRPA benefits because the trust is projected to remain above 90%, the HB 55 trust. And similarly, we did not assume any increases in the 8% member contributions because that is an action that the ARM board would have to take, and there's no set parameter or like there is with the PRPA falling below 90%. The member contributions would be increased by the ARM board, and that can be increased to whatever they choose to increase it to, up to the 12% maximum. There is another cost of living adjustment that PERS members receive currently. That's the Alaska residency cost of living adjustment. That's a flat 10% increase, and that's given to retired members who remain in Alaska during their retirement years. That 10% residency COLA is not part of the proposed bill. So the only cost of living adjustment that HB 55 members would receive is the PRPA, not the Alaska residency COLA, cost of living adjustment. So that's basically the summary. I'd be happy to respond to any questions that committee members may have.
Well, Mr. Kirshner, thank you very much for providing this letter to the committee. I actually have a few questions and then want to open it up for questions from the other members. And I'm actually referring to page 5 for the members who got the letter in front of them. So it's my understanding that there are about 708 individuals who do not have the ability to transfer all of their service in the defined contribution plan to defined benefit, and so those individuals would be indebted to the state. And can you talk about those 700 individuals? What happens? Let's say that they are $10,000 short or whatever. What happens to those individuals if this bill were to pass and they were to choose they were to go into the defined benefit program?
Of the 708 members didn't have enough funds in their defined contribution accounts, both the employer balance and their own employee balance, to purchase all of their service that they currently have under the DCR plan. So we assumed that they would transfer as much as they could using their defined contribution account balances. And if a member does not have sufficient funds in their defined contribution balance accounts to purchase service, they can purchase service by creating an indebtedness to the plan. And so let's just say that a member needs $50,000 of additional funds to purchase all of their service. They can do so, but they would have to put in an extra $50,000. They would be indebted to the plan for that $50,000, which they would have to pay down over based on the indebted rules, indebtedness rules that all PERS members face. So that is permitted under the proposed bill. We did not assume any of those members would purchase that additional service, because there's no net effect. Whether somebody has suppose somebody can get 5 years of service rather than 8 years of service, and that extra 3 years is what costs the $50,000 in my example. There's no net impact on an actuarial basis whether we assumed they would have all 8 years of service, but then there would be a $50,000 indebtedness paid to the pay to the plan versus assuming that they only got 5 years of service with no indebtedness, because the indebtedness, the extra, in my example, the $50,000 is really would be an additional asset coming into the plan to pay $50,000 worth of liability for that extra 3 years of service in that example. So from an actuarial perspective, there's no difference whether we include or did not or exclude the indebtedness. For simplicity, we assumed no indebtedness would be created.
Thank you for that. And
does that address your question?
Yes, it does. I appreciate that. Can you tell me why House Bill 55 assumes a 7.38% return on investment when the ARM board is projecting a 6.6 for the next decade?
Well, I'm not sure where the 6.6% for the next decade is projected, but the 7.38%, let me take a step back. Alaska statutes require the Alaska Retirement Management Board to have the actuary, which is us, conduct an experience study at least once every 4 years to review the actuarial assumptions that are used to determine the contributions to the plan that are determined every year. Those actuarial assumptions include some of the assumptions that I talked about a few minutes ago of projecting which current members are expected to be employed when they retire and when they're expected to retire. There are lots of assumptions. Perhaps the biggest, most influential assumption on the impact of costs is what the invested assets in the plan are expected to earn. That assumption is currently 7.38%. That was set back in 2018 based on the, it was ultimately 2019, based on the 2017 experience study that was done at that time. Prior to that experience study, that 7.38% was 8%. And because of changing capital market expectations and lower expected returns on equities and all sorts of other different asset classes, that expected return assumption, which was 8%, down to 7.38 4 years ago, that's the reason why that expected return rate has dropped. We're currently in the middle of the next four-year experience study for assumptions that will become effective beginning with the 2022 valuations. But the 7.38% was used for this analysis because that's the current assumption that the ARM board has adopted regarding the expected return assumption. Now, we know that over any given period of time, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, whatever period you look at, we know we're not going to earn 7.38%. In some years, we'll earn more. For example, the year that just ended in June of 2021, the plans earned about a 30% market return, which was a phenomenal year due to asset markets. Now, we could very well have a reversal of that in the year that we're sitting in currently, but in any given year, the trust can earn more or less than the assumed rate, which in this case is 7.38. But over the long term, which is what all of our funding calculations are looking at, is the long term. The long term assumption is currently 7.38%.
Mr. Kirshner, I just have one final question before I go to Senator Michiki. Alaska statutes require that an actuarial report is done on any bill of this nature, and does this letter of March 4th satisfy that statutory requirement?
Yes, it does.
Senator Michiki?
Yeah, so on that 7.38 versus 8%. That's a pretty significant drop. What would cause that kind of reduction from 8% to 7.3% in one evaluation period?
Well, it doesn't happen over the change doesn't happen overnight. Every year you have changing capital market expectations. You have different expectations about what future inflation rates are going to be. You have different assumptions about what equity returns are going to be, what bond yields are going to be, all the different asset classes that the plan's assets are invested in. And those allocations or those invested asset, how much is invested in equities versus bonds, et cetera, those also change over time. And so back in when the 8% return was set, the last time an 8% return assumption was set was back in 2014, the 2013 experience study that was evaluated by the board in 2014, and then new assumptions were adopted at that time. Based on capital market expectations and the plan's invested allocation strategy, 8% was the best estimate at that time. 4 years later, the asset allocation strategy has shifted, so there might be less a more conservative allocation, so there might be more money invested in bonds versus equities than there were 4 years ago, as well as changing capital market expectations. So expected equity returns in 2018 were lower in general than they were in 2014, just because of the changing nature of foreign markets. And I mean, I'm not an investment professional, but that's the general explanation, is that changing capital market expectations and changing asset allocation, those change over time. And every time those change and we come up to a new four-year experience study, we evaluate the assumptions at that time and we set the assumptions based on those expectations at that time. And 4 years from now, we will have different expectations and perhaps allocation strategies that then the next experience study in 4 years from now would then evaluate those conditions at that time in setting the assumption.
Senator Michicki?
So to just continue on, that the drop from 8 to 7.3, it was 0.62. Just assuming, what if there was another 0.62 drop in this next experience? I know we look at the long term, and I don't know what the averages are across the country, but how would that stress this plan if we were to pass HB 55, if it were to drop another 0.62?
Well, when we lower the assumed return, like from 8 to 7.38, and if we lower it from 7.38 to something lower than that now, every time you lower that assumed return, it increases the liabilities of the plan. And the reason for that is if you need to have $1,000 in 5 years from now to pay a benefit, to pay someone's benefit, if you're going to earn 8% every year, you don't need to have as much money set aside today to pay $1,000 5 years from now. If you're only going to earn 7.38, you need to have more money set aside today to make up for that shortfall in the assumed return to have $1,000. So the liabilities, which is that amount that you need to set aside today to pay for that benefit, those liabilities go up when you lower the assumed return. Now, if we had done this analysis using something other than 7.38, let's just say we decided to use 6.5% as an example. All of our numbers are before HB 55 numbers. Contributions would all be higher than what we're currently projecting, which is based on 7.38. because the lower return, 6.5%, is going to affect our current state, our current, in other words, before HB 55, projections are all going to be higher. And similarly, the HB 55 contribution projections would be higher than what we currently have included. But the relative difference between those two, whether the difference is done at 7.38 or in my example, 6.5%, the relative impact should be the difference between before and after HB 55 should be relatively the same. Now, having said that, if you think back to 2006, when the decision was made in 2006 to close the defined benefit plans to future hires, one of the motivating factors in that decision was to reduce some of the risk that the state bears by having these promised benefits, these defined benefit pension benefits, pensions that are promised to the retirees. Because under a defined benefit plan, if somebody is due a benefit of $1,000 per month for the rest of their life, they're going to get $1,000 per month for the rest of their life, whether there's enough assets in the plan to pay for it or there's not enough assets in the plan to pay for it. That's a guaranteed benefit. And the challenge in that case then is to make sure that there's sufficient money on hand in the trust to pay that all those promised benefits. So that's what our annual actuarial evaluations accomplish, is to determine for that given year how much needs to be contributed. So if HB 55 were to pass, and which means we have more people in the defined benefit plan, and all future hires will come into the defined benefit plan, so the defined benefit plan population will continue to grow. As that plan grows, the liabilities grow and the assets grow. And so when you, in that case, if we were to have adverse plan experience, like if we're assuming 8% or if we're assuming 7%, but we only earn a 2% return, that asset loss has to be made up by future contributions, and that leads to the higher, that would lead to the higher state contributions. So there is increase, and that's stated on the first page of our March 4th letter, that by opening up the defined benefit plan to these peace officers and firefighters, the state is taking on more risk because the defined benefit plan will continue to get larger and larger, as opposed to currently it's projected to get smaller and smaller as the covered population ultimately retires, and then ultimately there's no more retirees. But by reopening the defined benefit plan, there is increased risk to the state. Now, some of that risk is mitigated by some of the as we talked about earlier, those levers that the ARM board can control, but you can't eliminate that risk entirely. You can just reduce some of it to protect against things like future adverse asset returns.
Senator Machicki?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I don't know what you have planned today, but I just have a couple more questions for now.
Okay, and just to let others know what the plan is, we have Senator Gray Jackson who'd like to ask a few questions. I have three individuals who are waiting online to provide testimony. I would like to get to them at this point. Each of them gets about 10 minutes. So just keeping that in mind, obviously appreciate the questions and that's the plan for this afternoon. So okay. Senator Machicki.
Yeah, thank you. So considering what you just said, one of the things you said is that since we closed the DB plan, we expected the liability to shrink, and reopening it will actually make it grow. However, doesn't it just shrink slower considering it's a smaller subset of the total state employees? Would the liability grow, or would it, the existing liability, shrink slower? I hope I'm wording that fine. But...
Well, let's talk about what currently, if without HB 55, the current, the liabilities of the current defined benefit plan, those are expected to continue to increase for a certain period of time. And then ultimately, as the current active population gets smaller and smaller because there's no new hires coming into the defined benefit plan, as the active population gets smaller and smaller because some of them retire, some of them leave employment and don't receive and won't receive their benefit in retirement, some people die before retirement. So that population is going to continue to get smaller, and then our current retired population is going to continue, is expected to decline as well, because those retirees are only expected to live a certain number of years. So currently, the defined benefit plan liabilities are expected to grow until there's a certain point where the population is such that there's more benefits being paid out than contributions coming in and investment income. And then ultimately, the plan's assets would be depleted down to zero once the last benefit to the last remaining retiree is paid. Under HB 55, the defined benefit plan would be open to at least for the peace officers and firefighters. So that portion of the plan's population would just continue to grow and grow and grow. The assumption is that as active members of the defined, when the plan is open, now again, we're only talking about it being open to the peace officers and firefighters, but for that portion of the open population, that active population is expected to remain stable. So as current members of the active population either retire or die or leave employment, we're assuming new hires will come into the plan to replace those exiting members.
Okay, ma'am.
That's what happens when we have an open defined benefit plan, which is what HB 55 does for the Peace Fire Group. So that portion of the plan's liabilities will not peak and then decline, which is what the pattern is under the plan being closed to all new hires. As new hires come in to the defined benefit plan, it keeps liabilities from declining, which is the pattern that we currently have.
Senator Machicki,
answer your question?
Well, sort of. I would like to see it graphed out, because I have the graph in my mind about the current exposure liabilities associated with the closed DB. In my mind, obviously, if this were to pass, you would layer on top of that Apex at some point somewhat later than what we've currently modeled, and then it would drop down until you reach this 1,600-plus member, and then slowly grow as that subset of state employees. And I can't remember, 20-something thousand, 25 or 26,000 are still in the old DB plan. So it would be nice to see that in a graph so we could understand the long-term effects of adding a small subset of state employees on how it affects the overall unfunded liability of the state over time.
Senator Gray Jackson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for your comprehensive analysis of the fiscal note. But you talked about how the HB 55 eliminates the 10% COLA benefit, but it also there's also a minimum age of 55 to collect, and there also is no Cadillac health plan. And, you know, as everybody knows, we have a really large problem with retention, and your actuary factors in increased retention. But do you think the new plan would improve our situation with regard to retaining qualified and experienced public safety employees?
Well, I can't speak entirely. I can't answer that question entirely because I don't know what the what current issues the state is facing in attracting and retaining qualified peace fire workers. But in general, the general expectation is that when you have a defined benefit plan versus a defined contribution plan, typically people that are workers that are covered by a defined contribution plan tend to be more mobile because they can transfer from one employer to another. And they typically, if they do transfer from one employer to another, they typically take their whatever defined contribution account balances they have. Now, there might be some vesting that applies to the employer portion, but generally, people are more mobile. It's a more mobile workforce if you're covered by a defined contribution plan, because in a defined benefit plan, you have incentives built in based on the structure and design of the plan. As you mentioned, you have to wait until at least generally until 55 before you can start receiving benefits. Now there are some, you can receive benefits if you have a certain number of years of service, regardless of your age. But generally, a defined benefit plan provides incentives to people to stay in employment so that they can ultimately receive that defined benefit pension, which is paid for their life, their lifetime. So we generally see more turnover of a workforce if it's covered by a defined contribution plan versus a defined benefit plan. So that's why we have and in our ongoing actuarial evaluations, where we do make assumptions about all sorts of future events, we have something that's called a withdrawal assumption, which assumes a certain percentage of people at various ages are going to terminate during their employment during the year. And if you compare those withdrawal rates that we have for the defined benefit plan population versus the defined contribution retirement plan population, the withdrawal rates for the defined benefit plan are lower because of that assumed decreased mobility. So we expect more retention for members that are in a defined benefit plan. Now, how that translates to actual experience for the state, I really can't speak to that because I don't have those details.
Can I follow up, Madam Chair?
Senator Gray Jackson.
Thank you. Just for your information, not only is the state having difficulty retaining public safety employees, but so is the municipality of Anchorage. I just wanted to make that comment. But can you briefly respond to my next question? And my next question is the ability to raise employee contribution rates and also withhold inflation rate adjustments from retirees. How does that reduce the risk for the state? Can you briefly respond? Thank you.
Sure. If the board were to raise the member contributions, that means less money has to be paid by the employers, the participating employers, and the state. So if the member contributions were to go from 8%, if they were to, instead of being 8%, if they were 10%, that means more money, a greater portion of the pension benefit liabilities are going to be funded by the member contributions rather than the employer and state contributions.
Thank you.
So,
thank you, Madam Chair.
That's how that would affect the costs.
Thank you, Mr. Kirshner. And if members have questions that you would like to see answered by Mr. Kirshner or Buck, please send them to my office. I do have three other individuals who are waiting online to testify. The first is William Fornia, who's the pension trustee advisor with the Coalition of Firefighters. I also have Ryan Frost, who's a policy analyst for the Reason Foundation. And then I've got Brad Flitch, who is a self-chartered financial analyst. All of them would like to comment on this report and the bill. So with that, Mr. Fornia, if you could, I know we've got your PowerPoint here in front of us. I, much of it goes over the bill and what it does, but could you summarize your PowerPoint so that we can get to the other individuals who are also waiting online?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And I understand I have about 10 minutes, so I'll move relatively quickly. And I think I can see my PowerPoint on the screen. But why don't we just go, I mean, the second page is just my credentials. And similarly to David and Scott from Buck, I'm a fellow of the Society of Actuaries, so all three of us are, you know, fully credentialed to opine on this kind of a situation.
If you
page
mind,
three, I just want to mention that I have worked in Alaska. And I think I met you, Madam Chair, about 8 years ago when I was working for another labor coalition. But prior to starting
Mr.
my own
Fornia,
firm, I was the...
Oh, I'm sorry to interrupt. And do you mind stating your name and affiliation for the record just so that we can document that and those who are listening online understand who they're hearing from? So thank you.
Thank you very much, and I apologize, Madam Chair. My name is William Fornia. I'm an actuary. I was hired by the Firefighters Association, and I'm testifying on behalf, in favor of the bill, on behalf of my client, the firefighters. I have my own firm, Pension Trustee Advisors. I'm based out of Colorado, and prior to my own firm, I've done work for the state, both for the ARM board, both as the first reviewing actuary. So I don't know if you all recall, but you know, shortly after you closed the plan, you decided you wanted to have a new actuary in for one, which was Buck. And then you had a reviewing actuary that was hired by the ARM board to review everything that Buck did. And then a few years later, when I was working for a different firm, I was actually hired again by the ARM board to be the auditing actuary. So we replicated everything that Buck had done. And so I guess I've been working for Alaskans in some manner since about 2005. And it's a real privilege. I'm sorry I'm not in Juneau today. But let me move quickly because I know you have a lot to go through. On my slide four, I have a quick chart as to why you need to do this plan. And I think you kind of addressed some of those issues when you talked about issues like retention. Because if you look at slide five, you can see, you know, when you do the math, this tier three defined benefit plan, which is what they could have had if they had been hired earlier, was dramatically higher than the tier four defined contribution plan. And it's not a whole lot, which is actually not a whole lot higher than Social Security. So anyone in Alaska that's covered by Social Security, which all of your private sector people are, they're getting almost as much in pension benefits as your folks are under the DCR plan. So clearly there was a need for this. I'm going to skip over slide six and jump to slide seven. So I reviewed what Buck had done, and I think David, Mr. Kirshner, is right on target. The risk that you have to the state is adverse plan experience. Now, I have to mention that Senator Mucci asked a question about liabilities going up, and Kirshner answered that. But what was not clear from your question to him or me is that you meant unfunded liabilities. Unfunded liabilities are deliberately designed not to go up. The whole point of this new tier is we want to make sure we don't create unfunded liabilities. So if you look at slide eight, we basically are targeting that this plan is going to be, in your case, I estimate 114% funded. So we're funding it hoping to be 114% funded. But if things don't turn out the way the actuaries think, if Kirshner's 7.38 is wrong, we've got these buffers Let me go to slide nine. The first safeguard is that we designed a leaner plan than your tier three is. We took away the Alaska cost of living adjustment for your Alaska residencies. We made them work till 55. We and we make it based on the 5-year pay instead of 3. Those are this, and so then the last two bullets is we if the plan dips below, we suspend that post retirement pension adjustment for a year. We increase the employee contributions. We design this plan so that to try to make it as bulletproof as we can, because we know there's risk that things don't turn out as favorable as actuaries think they're going to turn out. So we put in all these safeguards. Slide 10 is we have this margin. That's what, remember when Mr. Kirshner said that this is mitigated somewhat as long as the cost stays below 9%. That's the whole idea. We built it in so that we think the cost is, we think we're going to be overfunding this plan. And in fact, the unfunded liabilities would actually go down for the group as a whole. But, you know, but if our assumptions were wrong, there's cushions in there. Slide 11 is we reduce the discount rate. So while Buck uses 7.38, we said, well, why don't we build this plan around a 7? We just really want to put in the safeguards we can so that the state is risks is less and less. And you know, the whole idea is that we don't want to have the same problems with this plan that we had 20 years ago with your big plan. Let me move to slide 12 quickly. So I was asked by my client to do some kind of threshold testing. I mentioned that, you know, so the ARM board actuary uses 7.38. We built around 7, and I tried to figure out what rate would it take to avoid hitting that 90%. Because 90% is when the pain starts to hit for your workers. And what we determined is as long as you can earn 6.62, you won't be below 90%, at least for the next 50 years. And then as long as you earn at least 6.49, you won't ever hit that if you go below 6.49, that's when you start to get these employee contribution increases. And finally, as long as you don't earn more than 5.43 every year, the suspending of that post-retirement pension adjustment would do the trick. So we, you know, it's certainly possible you'll have years here and there where you go below 90%, the contributions ratchet up a little bit, the PRPA is suspended, but we've really tried to do what we can to keep the plan from being okay. And that's where slide 13 comes in. We did these simulations, and Senator Costello, you asked about the 6.6%. That might be, you might have seen that from our work. One of the investment consultants for the ARM board was projecting 6.6% for the next 10 years. Now, that was 2 years ago, so they got the first 2 years wrong. But we tried it. We tried to test it. We tried to test what will happen if that happens. We really tried to look at everything that might go wrong and see how would that happen. And slide 15 is a graph. I think that's kind of one of the best stories. We looked at the years since inception, and we took the worst 20-year period, which was 2000 to 2020. So like if we had started this right before the tech bubble was about to burst and 8 years before the financial crisis was about to hit, you know, what would happen then? And that was that gray line. So we would have started out of 100% funded. We would have gone down to about 90, gone back up to close to 100 before the tech bubble hit, crashed down, bobbled around 90 for a while, and then we'd be well above it. We're trying to see how bad it can be. And then starting on page 16, we did some what we call stochastic plan simulations, where we looked at we modeled a bunch of different possible future returns to see, okay, how about if you take what the ARM board uses for some of their projected volatilities, and they use this 14% standard deviation, which if Mr. Kirshner is still on the phone, he's drooling over this because it's interesting for us actuaries, but it's a little confusing. And so we modeled what possible future activities could happen. And this, let me jump to slide 19, and then I'll take a minute for questions if you want them. So slide 19 shows, and it's a little bit tricky to read, but under these 10,000 simulations we had, we determined that there's a 23% chance that after 20 years you'd be 90% funded or below. But there's also a 23% chance that you'd be 149% funded or above. That's the challenge with these defined benefit plans is the returns are very, very volatile. Like the stock market. You know, in general the stock market goes up, but last week it went down. You know, so things really do vary, and which is why these defined benefit plans are so valuable to the workers, is because they don't have to worry about the day-to-day or the year-to-year fluctuation. You know, you join a pool of people, and hopefully over your entire life cycle, the plan turns out pretty well. And so the key is we aim high, and that's kind of what this chart on 19 shows. You know, we're very likely to be, you know, 110% plus funded. We're pretty reasonably likely to be even more than 149% funded. But that's all necessary to minimize the lack of being low. And if you look at those little wedges on the last bar, you can see the bottom isn't that bad. Well, the bottom isn't that bad because we suspend the PRPA and we raise the employee contributions if things start to get bad. So, you know, this plan was really designed as much as possible to build in safeguards. And in the interest of time, I've got some examples of other states here in my presentation, but I think it's best use of my time if you take some questions, if you have any.
Thank you, Mr. Farina. And we do have two additional individuals who are promised 10 minutes to present. I think what I'll do now is go to them and then take questions that can be fielded by any of the individuals who've been a part of this afternoon's meeting. But thank you very much. For the public, we did just get the PowerPoint after the meeting started, so that will be uploaded as soon as possible. And if any of the other presenters have anything they'd like to have us upload to the official bill documentation, please let me know. Next, we have Ryan Frost. Ryan, if you could please introduce yourself to the committee and provide your comments on the bill. We do usually end at 3 o'clock, but I'm going to extend the committee meeting for a while as long as members can stay.
Thank you, Senator Costello. Good afternoon. My name is Ryan Frost. I'm a policy analyst with the Pension Integrity Project at Reason Foundation. I've been with Reason since 2019, and prior to that, I spent a little over 7 years as the Senior Research and Policy Manager for the Law Enforcement Officers and Firefighters Pension System in Washington State. That plan has been one of the top three best-funded plans since its inception in the mid-70s, and that's primarily been accomplished by keeping up to date with best practices in pension plan and funding design. Our pension team has played a key pro bono technical assistance role on 55 pension reforms over the past 6 years, the two largest being the public safety plan in Arizona.
Ryan,
Ryan,
I hate to interrupt, but we do have you on Teams. If you'd like to turn on your camera, that'd be great. If not, I just want to give you that opportunity.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. I don't know if the internet would be stable enough to turn on both, so I was doing audio today.
Okay, thank you.
Sorry about that. So the pension reforms we have worked on include new defined benefit pension tiers, new hybrid design tiers, new cash balance tiers, and new defined contribution tiers. And accordingly, our team is fairly agnostic on plan design. We're not really DC or bus zealots. In fact, most of the reforms we've worked on have included a defined benefit pension component. But each of those reforms has, at its very foundation, a way of paying for the system that ensures costs don't eat into state and local budgets, and that these benefits earned by employees are fully funded for their retirement. House Bill 55, which opens a new defined benefit tier for public safety officers and firefighters, does far too little to prevent growing unfunded pension liabilities, supports the bill claiming that certain tweaks to the new pension would eliminate the financial risk to the state. However, the tweaks have faced extremely minimal actuarial scrutiny to support those claims, and there's no publicly available long-term actuarial forecasting or stress testing to justify such a financially profound policy decision. While the bill does have a few modest improvements relative to the legacy pension tier, overall it's still a fairly weak design and lacks sufficient controls to justify the assertion there's no risk to the state and local budgets as there is with the current DC plan today. recognizing the need for some of the long-term perspective on funding and costs, we actually prepared some preliminary modeling of the proposed new House Bill 55 tier. And the results of our analysis indicate that House Bill 55 would likely expose the state to new and growing unfunded liabilities. Instead of around a $743 million bill for employee contributions over an observed 30-year window, assuming all current actuarial and demographic assumptions are met, Alaska would be responsible for paying about $900 million due to the need to service growing unfunded liabilities. And that analysis is available on our website. I'd be happy to share it with committee members if they wish. Public pension systems operate over generations, but state legislators have only been presented with a minimal five-year cost projection based on an assumption that the proposed pension tier would do the impossible, hit all of its actuarial assumptions. In short, House Bill 55 only works as intended and as it's being sold if Alaska PERS does something it's never once accomplished in its entire history, which is get 100% of its assumptions, 100% of the right, 100% right, 100% of the time. And despite practically flying blind to the risks and long-term trajectory of the new pension tier, the Alaska House passed it out of its chamber last year. The updated fiscal note from Buck is, as they said themselves, is very similar to the previous fiscal note, only being updated for results of the latest actuarial valuation and the effects of Senate Bill 55. A proper actuarial analysis of this proposal still, in our view, has not been conducted. Take, for example, a bill recently passed in Washington State for its police and fire system. And that system's been overfunded since its inception in the 70s through prudent risk analysis and funding design. And the state actuary of Washington fiscal note for that multiplier increase, which is a relatively the first benefit increase was passed this year, which is a multiplier increase. And the state actuary's fiscal note for that multiplier increase, which is a relatively minuscule task compared to a complete pension design overhaul, is a shining example of the level of detail that has to be considered when you're adjusting a pension benefit. Just a few of the things that the state actuary of Washington fiscal note includes that the Buck fiscal note doesn't is a 25-year cost to the state, stochastic modeling to assess the effect of unexpected experience under thousands of potential outcomes, expected chance that contribution rates will exceed a certain percentage, sensitivity analysis on retirement rates due to the effects of the bill passage, and a funded status trajectory going out 30 years. Even with the limited scope and rigor of the updated fiscal note, Buck's analysis, as they said themselves, still does raise some concerns for state policymakers by stating that adverse plan experience or changes to more conservative assumptions will increase the PERS DB unfunded liabilities, resulting in higher contribution rates. And moreover, on day one of this new tier being open, the plan will have up to 15 years of liabilities already on its books because under House Bill 55, any member who chooses to enter into the new tier can have all their previously earned service in the DC transferred. And all of that service is transferred using an unrealistically high discount rate of 7.3%. That 7.3% that's been talked about a little bit today, it's completely out of step with national trends. The national median has been falling rapidly, and it's now under 7%. The biggest plans in the country are now under 7. CalPERS is at 6.8. New York is at 5.9. They're all moving down into the mid to upper sixes. And so what this does, by transferring all this service at too high of a discount rate, it sets up a pension obligation bond-like situation where any downturn in market performance or lowering of assumptions would quickly create unfunded liabilities in the system in year two or three. And to touch on the 7.3% again, previous proposals to put public safety in a defined benefit plan, specifically House Bill 79 from 2020, actually used a lower assumed rate. They used 7. 79 is nearly identical to 55, apart from a few changes to assumptions and minimum employee contribution rates. So it's unclear why this proposal is going the opposite direction on investment risk in previous iterations by using that higher rate. Our hypothesis is that 7% assumption would raise the normal cost too high for a cost-neutral argument to hold any water because even fewer dollars then would be coming to legacy debt. Additionally, Buck also notes a critical point that the current DC benefit offers almost the exact same retirement benefit as proposed under House Bill 55, suggesting that if you simply increase the employee contribution in the current DC and added more annuity purchase options in the current plan, they could yield an equivalent benefit and provide lifetime income options. A line from their fiscal note states that on average, approximately 94% of the DC service as of June 30th, 2021 was credited to the PERS DB. This means that assets in the current DC plan holdings would cover nearly all the equivalent liabilities in the proposed new House Bill 55 pension tier. And it's also another potential explanation for why the supporters decided to use a 7.38 over 7, because using a 7 would make the service credit purchase actually more expensive at the time of transfer, meaning that members entering this new pension tier would be effectively taking a benefit cut. I'll try and wrap up a few questions that we've yet to see answers. One, what would it take to push the actuarially determined rate above the 9% employer contribution floor? That's the first question that should have been asked in the committee hearing on the first bill. There's a strong likelihood, and you don't know how much until you get a real actuarial analysis done, that this arbitrarily high 7.38 rate is going to need to be lowered within the first 5 years of the new tier's life to keep up with larger pension trends. And when that happens, costs will necessarily increase. House Bill 55 is being proposed by groups concerned with recruitment and retention. They claim that they're having trouble recruiting and retaining members due to a lack of a DB pension for their members. However, this claim doesn't really hold up to data across the country, as 86% of police stations across the U.S. are facing shortages, and every single one of those stations outside of Alaska has a pension with some defined benefit component to it. In fact, we even have an academic working paper that shows teacher retention rates did not change at all when Alaska swapped from a DB to a DC in 2005. In conclusion, there is a way forward that can meet whatever needs the legislative body, stakeholders, and members desire, but House Bill 55, as it's currently written, would not put this new tier on a successful path. We'd be happy to work with the committee and stakeholders to help draft and design the best meets those needs. Thanks for your time. Be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ryan. And due to the time constraints, I'm going to go to our next presenter, our final presenter, and let the committee members know if you have any questions of any of the individuals. Please let my office know, and we will get answers to you. Next, Brad Flitch, if you could introduce yourself to the committee and give your background before you provide your comments, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good afternoon, Senators. My name is Brad Flitch. I am currently employed as a planning and investment officer for the city of Santa Fe, New Mexico. I lived in Juneau, Alaska for 30 years. I was an investment officer at the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. I worked at Sea Alaska Corporation, and I ran my own investment company for 17 years. I'm an enrolled tribal member with Central Council of Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska, and I've been a student of the pension plan since the early 80s, or early 90s, excuse me. So what I'd like to say on this here is a few main topics. Is one, defined benefit plans. The state of Alaska made an excellent decision by dropping the defined benefit plan and moving the employees to a defined contribution plan. Why? Because defined benefit plans were designed where employees worked for 30 years and contributed to the plan. And then within their retirement, they typically died within the first 10 years. So they would work for 30 years and receive benefits for 10. In that model, the defined benefit plan worked fine. But when people work for 30 years and retire for 40 or 50 years, the defined benefit plan fails in every actuarial study. You can't contribute enough, you cannot earn enough to meet that liability. Which leads me to my next point is pension funds. You really have only control over one thing, and that's contributions. You don't know what the markets are going to do. And in Alaska, you don't know what the liabilities are. And that's because of legislative tinkering to the plan. And that's what I would call this, legislative tinkering. Adding benefits, expanding the liability without a complete and total understanding of how the entire plan works. When you look at this here, the liabilities, the biggest problem in the liability and what will be the death nail of defined benefit plans is the ever-expanding life expectancy of Americans.
our life expectancy is growing. In speaking with a professor at Portland State University, his statement to me was, if you make it the next 10 years, you're probably going to make it the next 30. That's how medical advancements and how fast they're going to radically change how long Americans live. So, okay, let's see. The last thing I'd like to say is I've actually read the Buck actuarial report from 2020. It's 106 pages long. To call this seven-page brief an actuarial report is not credible at all. It doesn't answer questions. It doesn't tell you what the risks are. It explains really some very basic assumptions, and that's about it. In an actuarial report, you would want to see a thorough analysis with numbers, demographics, charts, and really nail it. And every time we heard them say that, oh, don't worry, we've mitigated the risk, in each case where the state mitigated the risk, the state paid more. It was like listening to the Fram commercial. You can pay me now or you can pay me later. Well, in this case, they're saying, well, the state's got to pay now. That way they don't have to pay later. But in either case, the state pays. If the real concern is retention, and I can only compare this to my community, Santa Fe, New Mexico has a, in my opinion, a better pension plan. Employees contribute less, and we get 3% per year of service, as opposed to 2 or 2.5% per year of service. The city of Santa Fe pays, out of the 25% contribution to the pension plan, employees only pay 3.66%. The employer pays the difference. Now, we have a $15,000 signing bonus for lateral police moves. And we have, and a better pension, defined benefit pension plan. And we have a 20% vacancy rate. So the assumption by tweaking the pension plan a wee bit like this is going to make a difference in your retention or hiring is absurd. The point you need to think about is if you're having a hard time hiring and retaining people, you need to take a look at your pay policy, your work environment, and your non-retirement benefits, such as childcare. The one question I would have, in all the extra contributions that HB 55 would require the state to make, what else could you do with that money instead of contributing it to the pension plan? What could you do to really make employment at the state of Alaska more attractive or in the police and fire? Anyway, thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Mr. Flitch. And we have gone 10 minutes beyond the regular committee time. So I want to say thank you to the members for their patience, and also say that if you have any questions of any of the testifiers, please let me know and my office will pass those on. And that concludes this afternoon's meeting. Our next meeting will be Monday, April 11th at 1:30, and we are adjourned.